says tomorrow is no different.
Hello, my name is Tristan Nieslijn, and you're listening to Tomorrow's Motorsport, the podcast looking at the future of innovation, transformation, and performance in the motorsport industry. I'm joined today by Nick Butcher from Ignition Human Performance. Nick, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Tris. Another week and another fantastic guest that we've got. With this guest this week, fresh from the Hungarian Grand Prix, which was her last race for Aston Martin F1. Of course, we're talking about Bernie Collins, who's the head of race strategy. And really great opportunity to catch up with Bernie as she's sort of transitioning from race life into civilian life. And we've been doing a bit with her at Ignition Human Performance on our motorsport speakers side. So we thought, yeah, let's talk about her opinions, a very fresh opinion from that, on what she thinks tomorrow's motorsport is going to look like from a race strategy point of view.
Absolutely. So Bernie Collins has been an undoubted star in the F1 paddock, working at McLaren F1 straight out of university, and then with the Silverstone team of Force India, Racing Point and Aston Martin. It's been a Formula One career spanning in excess of 7 years, many rule changes and thousands of air miles clocked up in the pursuit of the perfect racing strategy. Our conversation brings you behind the curtain of strategy in Formula One and the future of what it will take to win in the world's fastest motorsport.
This is Tomorrow's Motorsport.
Bernie Collins, it's fantastic to have you with us here on Tomorrow's Motorsport. How are you today?
Yeah, very well, thank you. It's lovely to be here and speak to you both.
Yeah, it's really a great pleasure to speak with you as well. And congratulations on your F1 career, and especially for what's coming next. I'm sure many people who are listening today will be very interested in hearing how your career in motorsport got started, and really how it developed to this point.
Yeah, so my career in motorsport, I think, doesn't necessarily fit what a lot of people imagine. A lot of people imagine people who always wanted to work in F1 or always knowing they want to work in motorsport had this very well-defined, proven, planned-out career path. And mine didn't really follow that in any way, in that when I was younger, when I was sort of at school, I really enjoyed like mathematics and physics and those sorts of things. But I didn't have a career I necessarily wanted to follow. I didn't really have a good idea of what I could do. So I did mechanical engineering because that seemed to tick a lot of boxes, and there was lots of opportunities at the end of that. But then through that, I sort of realized that, you know, automotive, motorsport, those sorts of things fitted what I wanted from a career. And what I mean by that is like a lot of variety, a lot of teamwork, not just a 9-to-5 at a desk all day. And it really progressed from there. I was fortunate enough that post-graduating, I joined the McLaren graduate scheme, some McLaren F1 graduate scheme, where I spent some time in all their different departments. And then began as a graduate design engineer, actually, within McLaren. So working on suspension and then moving to gearboxes. And then from then, really, I built this drive within me to be at the track. And I sort of tried to build experience to prove that I wanted to be there, but also to just to prove to for myself to know that I wanted to be there. So I started to work with the GT program, which McLaren were doing at the time. Done a lot of extra weekend work to get involved with that, and a lot of late nights at a track, doing all sorts of jobs in GT because there's not enough people. So it's just everyone gets stuck in. And then from that went trackside with McLaren as performance engineer in 2014, well, a little bit of 2013, but 2014, working with Jensen Button. And that was really great experience. That was the first time I'd done a full season. You got to travel the world, you got to see a lot, you got to work as part of that team, which was a really great experience. And then in 2015, I moved to what was then Force India, now Aston Martin, and began to work with those guys as a strategy engineer. So that was actually my first experience of strategy. So my career sort of taken opportunities that have arisen, but not necessarily been planned out. And I've worked with Aston Martin from 2015 until the last Grand Prix, so Hungary Grand Prix. So that's been sort of 7 years with those guys, which has been an experience, a few laps of the globe now, it feels like. and a lot of time on the pit wall, but it's been really, yeah, it was a really great experience, and I'm sort of really happy that we've got to do that.
And of course, your last Grand Prix was in Hungary, which at time of recording was a couple of weeks ago. And you even had Sebastian Vettel at the end sort of say that he'd really enjoyed working with you. What was that like, sort of as you were going to each Grand Prix, knowing that it might, you know, sort of potentially, because obviously you don't know where what it looks like in the future, might be your last Grand Prix? And what did that feel different as you were sort of planning the races? How did that feel as you went into those last few Grand Prix?
Yeah, so I sort of decided in the winter between the 21 and the 22 season that I wasn't going to continue beyond the middle of this season. So it's 6 months notice to do. And that was really interesting time because, you know, naturally over the years, you start to maybe focus on the negative things about your job. But then I had 6 months to really enjoy all the really positive things about my job and really enjoy the decision making, enjoy the influence I had on the races, enjoy the places that we were going to. Obviously, some of the traveling started to open up a little bit again now. But those 6 months were a really lovely experience to really take all of the positives from my job. And I felt very fortunate at times because very few people get to leave a job they love before they don't love it anymore. And I actually really love strategy. I really loved my job on the pit wall. And, you know, I really loved the influence I had. I enjoy the pressure of a race weekend. And, you know, that's even in a season where the car's not necessarily performing as well as we would all like. But there are, you know, there are aspects of my role and aspects of my job that I absolutely love. And it was really nice to have those 6 months to say, right, I'm going to take absolutely every positive I can out of this experience and walk away from it. And I felt a lot calmer. You know, there was this new calmness within me when making decisions, when under pressure, when reacting to situations that were thrown at me. And yeah, you know, you go to it and you think, well, this might be my last time on the pit wall in Budapest. And sure, because Budapest was the last one, you know, like you say, for now, we don't know what the future holds. It was really emotional experience. And I think Sebastian had picked up on that, like you say. And then, you know, his comment at the end was really lovely because in that situation, those guys have a lot going on. So I'm not expecting him to be thinking about my last race. And in many ways, I give him a lot of abuse for announcing his retirement on my last weekend. It felt like he'd stolen that a little bit from me. But yeah, it was a really special, and it's really lovely to hear, you know, so many people say so many positive things within the team, in the pit lane, various journalists I speak to, various people from other teams. And you don't often get to experience that when you're leaving a role.
No.
And that felt really, you know, I wouldn't change that aspect of how we've ended. It was quite nice.
Yeah, because I suppose in Formula One, actually, if you were going directly to another team, it would have been very much sort of, well, you're spending 6 months to a year on garden leave and sort of it starts again. So, no, it's great. And it was also nice to hear, obviously, the Sky coverage with David Croft mentioned you as well. So fantastic, and really shows what a sort of a career and reputation you've built within the sport. But strategy is such an important part of a Grand Prix. But it's fair to say that what we see on the pit wall is probably just the tip of the iceberg. Why don't you just sort of explain to people who are listening what goes into a Grand Prix weekend from a strategy point of view, just to give us a bit of an insight into that side of things?
Yeah, I think like a lot of what's visual in all of F1 is very much the tip of the iceberg. So if you think of like, we all see the driver on the podium at the end of the race, but he's, let's say, the representation of hundreds of people at the factory that have brought the car together, brought the race together, brought the team together. There are lots of people in the background at every stage, and that's the same on strategy. So although for the majority of the races, I sat on the pit wall as the head of strategy, and I made a lot of the final decisions, there's this team behind us. So we have a team of people back in Mission Control, as we call it, that's based in Silverstone for Aston Martin, but, you know, generally around the UK for all the UK-based teams. And that consists of anywhere between 4 to 10 people, depending on the team. and they're all feeding various bits of information in trying to make it as simplistic way as possible, so that the person making the decisions on the pit wall is taking in information that, one, they trust, and two, that's in the simplified format in a way that the decisions are much easier to make. So you're almost like spoon feeding the person at the top the information that they need. Sometimes that there's enough time to have all of the explanation behind it, and sometimes there's not. But yeah, like, we tend to work, if you think of a typical race weekend, like, you know, Budapest is a good example. The week before, we'll start to look at all the preparation, things like what normally happens at Budapest, what sort of weather conditions are we expecting, what qualifying pace or race pace have we had in the run-up to that, or everyone else. So where are we expected to qualify? Where are we expected to race? All of these sorts of things. What tyres we have and what we think the tyres will do. You know, do we think the hard's going to be better than the medium for a race tyre? Do we need to save more tyres for Sunday? So we started to form a plan of how we're going to run the weekend. And then through the weekend, we start to learn more and more bits of information. So you start to prove your tyre model. You start to prove the race strategy. And then at the end of the weekend, which to me is the most interesting bit, which seems maybe incorrect, but post-race, we spend probably the week after, at least sort of 3 or 4 days after, analysing what we've done. What would have happened if we'd stopped one lap earlier? What would have happened if we'd stopped one lap later? Different tyre, whatever the case may be. We go through a lot of these scenarios. You know, what should we have done differently? If we were to do the race again, what would we do differently? But we also spend a lot of time looking at everybody else. So there's 9 other teams on the grid to learn from. What did they do? Why? You know, did they have a piece of information we didn't have? Should they have done something different? If they made a mistake, then why? Or what can we learn from it? Or are we, you know, at risk of that same mistake? Or is there anything we can do to safeguard against that? So we spend a lot of our time learning and trying to improve going forward. You know, if, let's say, something in our model was incorrect on Saturday night that led us to do one strategy or another, you know, can we correct that? You know, was there some signs that that was wrong in advance from Friday, whatever? So there's this massive learning process, which I really enjoy. You know, that's one of the things I enjoy as an engineer. I think that's what drives a lot of people, is just the continuous learning. And that bit post-race is really interesting.
And how does that differ where you've had sort of the triple headers? How much time can you actually dedicate to the learnings from the previous race? Or do you have to quite quickly switch into the next Grand Prix? Or are the learnings from the previous Grand Prix useful for the next Grand Prix?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting problem in that the double headers and triple headers, like you say, you really compress what you can do. Often the thing that gets compressed the most is maybe preparation for the next one, because a lot of that, you know, a lot of the prep you can do, maybe you do a bit of it before the first, you know, let's say the second race, you might do some of the prep in advance of the first race, because some of the things like what the pit loss was next year, you can do in advance. And it very much depends on the situation. So let's say your two races were, you know, Monaco and Spain are typically together. The qualities of Monaco don't necessarily translate directly to Spain. So, you know, it's very difficult to overtake, or it's a track position race and qualifying is more important. All of these qualities of Monaco don't necessarily translate to Spain. So you need to look at what are the learnings that I think are key now and what can I come back to post Spain. So things like what pace we think other drivers had for qualifying is probably important. We'll carry that. But why someone pitted two laps later and got stuck in traffic, probably less so important. Yeah. So you sort of try and, with a feel for what your next race is, prioritise the work. But ultimately, it just ends up with everyone working, you know, harder, longer hours those days, working on a flight in between the two, whatever it might be, to try and get as much of the work as you can do done, and try and just make sure that you've not missed anything. You know, worst case scenario, you say, oh, I won't worry listening to X radio. Like, I won't bother listening to, you know, Red Bull's radio, because they're quite far ahead of us, maybe not relevant to us, but you miss something that does affect the next one. And that's really, that would be really difficult, I think, to do. So you end up just working more a little bit.
And what you talked there about Red Bull and the difference in teams. What is the different strategy in terms of the different decisions that are made between the top teams, the middle teams, the bottom teams? Where do you sort of see those differences? Because you could argue that actually decision-making for a top team, so where we saw Mercedes in 2014, where they were out in front, you could almost say that in many respects the pressure was off them because they knew one or other they'd get a 1-2. What I suppose what I'm trying to say is, what does success look like for a midfield team when you're looking at strategy and you haven't necessarily got that potential of a win or a podium? What are you looking for? Where are you looking for those sort of little increases, marginal gains, those sorts of areas?
Yeah, so if I sort of split the question up a little bit and say, okay, if we just think of the pressures are different at different ends of the grid. So the pressure at the front of the grid, you know, there's a lot more criticism from outside. There's a lot more scrutiny on decisions that are made. If you have the fastest car and you don't finish 1-2, that's a disaster, you know. But at some points for those cars, they can be less concerned about traffic because they know they have the pace to overtake. They can be less concerned about their Q1 because they know they're likely to go through. There's these, some of the decisions are simpler and some then have much larger consequences. And equally, if you look at some of those teams, the difference between a P2 and a P3 is massive on points. Whereas if you look at the difference between a P9 and P10, it's a much smaller difference on points. But it probably for that team has the same large effect on your overall championship finishing position. If you look at the midfield, particularly this year, but has been the case for several years, there's lots of cars very close together. And the pace difference between those group of cars, even to the very slowest cars at the back, is such that you absolutely cannot get caught in traffic. You cannot be a little bit slower on your pit stop. That's so detrimental to your race because you don't have the half a second to a second pace advantage that the front runners have to just blast past some traffic. You just cannot risk it. So the considerations are different and the pressure is different. Equally, if you think of the guys at the back of the field, you know, with the 10th fastest car, that's really difficult because, one, it's very grinding to do, you know, 23 races in a row with a highly unlikely chance of getting points. That is very grinding on a team and the people involved. And it starts to be that people are looking for really out there solutions, really out there opportunities. And often as a strategist, that fundamentally goes against what you believe is the fastest strategy. Mm. And that's really hard situation to manage. You know, you get teams that will always split the start tire or always take a risk on their safety car. Now, sometimes those things work off, but sometimes you just end up in an overall slower race. And that becomes very difficult because particularly for teams that are slower, that car has been passed from the factory through the track to that point. And you're sort of expected where you can to pick up the pieces of that car and see, you know, come up with this miracle strategy that the 9 other teams on the pit wall haven't thought about. You know, we're working with a lot of intelligent people and a lot of intelligent teams. So as the 9th or 10th fastest team, you're not going to come up with this strategy where the 8 other teams haven't thought about it. There is no miracle. So that, I think, is quite difficult. In terms of the how you analyse it, how you look at your race, how you say what you could have done differently. We always try and look at, there's a few ways. You can look at points lost over car expectations. So if we calculate we have the 4th fastest car, then you should have finished P7 and P8. And if you didn't finish in those positions, what are the reasons why? And those reasons might be reliability, power unit, traffic, whatever. And any of those positions that you can attribute to strategy are the bits that I look at. So if we say we have the 6th or the 7th or the 8th fastest team, then you shouldn't be in point scoring positions. And if you are, then again, what's that attributed to? So you can't just say, you know, for races in the past where we finished on the podium, and you know, some of them, wet Germany is a good example. Some of them, because of the final decision, was the right decision. You can't just look at that and say, well, the result was really good, so we must have had a really good race, because there's more to it than that. There's so many decisions go into that. Were all those decisions perfect? No. So what can we do to improve? We can't just say, oh, podium, tick, job yeah. done. We've got a podium with the fifth, sixth fastest car. We must have done a brilliant job,
yeah.
because that's not true. And equally, the people at the front will do the same. So, you know, Mercedes haven't won year on year by saying, oh, we won last year, we'll just park that. You know, they, like I've described, have nine other teams to look at and say, what did they do wrong? What did they, you know, and leave a look at their own decisions and say, well, was that risk worth it, given where we are? Should we have stopped one lap later? Should we have stopped one lap earlier? And they for sure still be going through all of that process, even having got 1-2, in order that you are learning from those mistakes. And, you know, Aston Martin, any of the teams at the back, are still going through all those processes, such that when they have a car that are fast enough, the group is good enough to perform at the level that's needed. So, and it's very easy in a team where you're not getting the time to feel disheartened, and feel like you've not done a good enough job, but you can only be responsible for your little bit. And that's the bit that's really difficult in a team sport, and I expect difficult in any team sport, but you know, you are led by the team, if you like.
Is it something that as the season goes on, the risks that are taken are more, or do you kind of keep to that same strategy where you're looking at, well, if we get, so say the car was in 11th place and a 10th place would be enough to get you 1 point ahead of the team that's ahead of you, that then gives you more in the Constructors' Championship? Or do you tend to find that if suddenly that could be a 7th place, but there might be a risk of a 12th place, for example? Do you find that as the season goes on, when you're looking at those things, the risks become higher, or it is very much stick to the original game plan?
I think that in general, the risks probably become higher. So you're probably, you know, it's easy at this stage of the season to say, I have 10, 11 races left, and you know you need to gain a point or 2 points a race on your competitor in order to gain a position in the championship. And that's very gradual. People work through it. But then it gets, you know, if you fail to achieve that and you get to the last race and you suddenly need to gain 3 points or 4 points, whatever it might be, it becomes a much bigger number. Then people tend to say, you know, you spend a lot of time in advance of the race looking at risk reward. Okay, well, getting one position up gains us this. If we lose a position, you know, and you try and balance it out against management, against the team structure, against the higher population. But people do feel more inclined to take the risks at the end. And sometimes that needs to be balanced with a reminder, because we're all racers. We all love it. We all want to do as well as we can. We all want the opportunity. And definitely if an opportunity exists, people just go, right, okay, let's go for it. And you get this like eternal optimism springs within the team. And sometimes you feel like the bad guy by saying, look, the best will in the world, I don't think we're going to hold Verstappen behind. So let's, you know, whatever it might be. So you end up being this sort of bad guy of realism saying, I don't think that's going to work. But yeah, people do feel more motivated to push on.
I can imagine there is that kind of push-pull sometimes. And well, the driver is the one who's going to be pushing to get as far up and as high up as it possibly can, because they know intrinsically they will make it work. It will happen. So that kind of dynamic. And I think in race as well, when maybe you're kind of saying, okay, this is our pit window, this is our time to stop, and the driver is also kind of saying, well, I feel okay and going on. How does that dynamic between kind of conservatives, well, you said there's not that much conservatism, but is there, what's that kind of like, and who ultimately kind of ends up winning out?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, we've not spoken maybe too much about it, but often the drivers have a different agenda. So, you know, we've had many years where we're trying to finish fourth or fifth in the championship and we're trying to score X many points as a team. But then you realise at some point during those final races that, you know, often it was Checo was trying to get to 100 points. He had this little, you know, drive in his head to get to the 100 points, or you would end up, you know, the driver's trying to beat X other driver in the championship, whatever it might be, to get their championship position. But as a team, we're trying to be very team focused. So you've got this two championships going on, and obviously we want to do as well as we can in both. But ultimately, in our position, often as a team, those aren't necessarily aligned. So you're trying to, you may need to sacrifice one driver, you know, which we totally try and avoid. And I think all teams try and avoid it because it does just lead to bad feeling. But you are ultimately paid because of the team finishing position, not because of the driver finishing position. But the drivers, you know, they're individual sportsmen and therefore selfish people. And we all would be in that position, so we get it. So that is often an interesting dynamic in itself. You often have, you know, for similar reasons, direction coming from the middle of the pit wall that is based on a team decision. And like I say, sometimes the information filters up and you don't necessarily have all of the whys behind it, but you have a bunch of information that you've made a decision on. And then you make a call to either side, to either driver, to box or not box, to stay out or to do X, Y, Z. And then, you know, ultimately you've got these two car crews that individually want their car crew to do well, but are working as a team. So it's a really interesting dynamic that you've got, like, this two sets of people. Now, you know, in the majority of people I've worked with, the majority of teams I work with, as soon as one car retires, let's say, everyone's helping the other car. Or if one car is an incident and qualifying needs to be rebuilt quickly, all of the mechanics are on one side of the garage. So do all work together, but you often get this sort of competitive edge at the end of a race where they do want to beat each other. And that is really difficult to manage well.
Yeah.
And sort of manage in a way that you don't deteriorate that relationship going forward. So we just end up with a set of rules. You know, a lot of teams are very, you see it all the time on the TV. You know, they'll switch the cars, give one car a chance to overtake. If it doesn't get the position, they'll switch them back. There's lots of pretty clear rules. So yeah, it's really interesting dynamic, I think.
As part of that strategy leadership position, are you thinking about that throughout a season? So Alpine, for example, this year, just racing each other, you know, and a lot of the time you're thinking that's completely inappropriate if when you're thinking about the bigger team game, but it's obviously a strategic decision to allow them to race.
Yeah, I think it's very, very dependent, in my experience, on your position in the championship. So there is a point, you know, the years that we were racing for fourth or fifth, every point counted, and literally you have to be ruthless and not care which driver gets the points. It doesn't matter to me on the score sheet. And for us, we were, you know, at least I tried to always be, I'm sure someone will say I wasn't, but you always try to be very, I literally don't care. And whoever, you always try and think during a race as logically as you can, which driver has the best chance of scoring the best points from where we are now. You know, normally that's the driver that's ahead on track, but it might not be because the driver that's ahead on track has some car issue that you're trying to manage, or doesn't have the right tire set to finish the end of the race because of what you've done in qualifying, or, you know, some other thing that you know is going to slow that driver down. Whereas the driver behind, you think, maybe does have a chance because of when they've stopped or what tires they've got on or whatever it might be. But normally it's going to be the lead driver. And then, you know, but for the front teams, you know, you see it more often, and the front teams get more criticized for it, for this impression of having a lead driver and a second driver. And it's normally one of the top three teams that, you know, people really latch onto that. But it's a bit different. They're trying to secure both the championships.
Yeah.
You know, in the midfield positions or the lower positions, what you're securing is constructors' championship primarily. You know, a driver will individually feel feel pressure to achieve a 9 or 10 or whatever it might be. But from a team, you're just worried about your constructors. So for us, we can be pretty selfless. They race in each other, as long as it's not costing you points, then it does open up an element of freedom within the team. You know, the difficulty that I think we're going to see going forward is with the resource restriction and stuff. And because it is quite tight, you just can't afford to be losing any parts, any bits, any time. It's so tight that you just can't be saying, if you lose a single point because you've raced each other, you've done the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Even if you lose a single position into turn one because the two of them are racing each other, that's ridiculous. So yeah, it's taken something that's so instinctive to the drivers and trying to control it, which is really difficult.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things actually that came to my mind while you were just talking is actually the Team Silverstone, whether that's been Force India, Racing Point, Aston Martin, has always had a real reputation for probably giving the biggest bang for its buck sort of thing in terms of getting the most point on the budget. And I remember a few years ago actually going up to the factory when it was Force India, and I remember one of your technical guys saying that, you know, if they're building a front wing, Red Bull has the potential to build 40 red front wings and crash tests and all the rest of it, whereas Force India didn't. In your opinion, how did the team do that?
Yeah, so I find it really, you know, I obviously moved from McLaren, which was and still is a powerhouse, to then Force India during that, you know, the middle of 2015. And I remember sort of turning up to the Force India's much smaller factory and walking into the design office. And I had previously, like I say, worked in like suspension design at McLaren at that point. There was around 10 of us split in front and rear suspensions. It was a massive group, or a big group. And you walked into Force India and you looked at the whole design office. And I was just like, where is everybody else? And they were like, well, this is it. And I said, okay, well, I remember at one point saying, well, where's the suspension department? And they were like, well, that guy is the suspension. I was like, that guy, that one person is the suspension, you know. And it's sort of like, or, and you know, gradually it's grown from that, but you sort of walk in and you think, and I've often thought about it since that, thinking, you know, when I was at McLaren, I was busy, I was working late, I did the occasional weekend, you were still working hard, and you're like, well, how is that possible that there's such a difference? And you sort of think, well, was I wasting my time? But definitely bits I was designing were making it to the car. And part of it, you know, if we think just purely from a design side, is, you know, more carryover, simplistic design, all of that sort of thing. I think at that stage, you know, resource restriction had come in terms of a budget cap type thing reasonably early, sort of around the 2011, 2012 sort of time was the first time that we started to have some restrictions, that type of thing. And I think the smaller teams, so simple things I can think of, like, you know, McLaren would draw a bearing just because the diameter was one or two different to what they absolutely wanted, whereas Force India were always picking a standard part off the shelf. So some of the adjustment was just there and some of the carryover was there. In terms of a race team, they operated with very, very little flashy equipment. We operated with all the stuff we needed, but a lot was really simplistic. And it's a bit like what we do from a strategy side. You sort of, what are the big ticket items? What is going to gain me the most? And it's always diminishing returns after that. But if you can always select the right big ticket items and just focus on those and, you know, do things like, say, we're not going to do a Monza wing.
Mm.
Okay, it's one race, but think of the resource that is. Or, you know, at the time that I moved, you know, McLaren had the four or five chassis they were running. They had maybe a spare chassis. I think at one point they had sort of like 6 to 7 chassis. Force India are operating on 2 or 3.
Presumably, some of that resource constraint, like having, for example, having less chassis, that must come into some kind of risk profiling that you do as well, in terms of, well, you know, actually, and maybe it's not this, maybe there's a better example that you could give us, But in terms of, you know, how hard you're going to push during a particular session, maybe in practice or something like that. Maybe the advice to the drivers about when they find the limit. And of course, you know, that then, I guess, carries over another kind of risk of going, actually, we don't know where the limit is until Q1, for example, or something like
that. Yeah, and for sure, you know, there's definitely elements of that where there's so many races that any of the teams further back in the grid, any of the teams with limited resource will say, right, we absolutely cannot, you know, the Singapores, the Monacos, the, any of those races where it's street circuits, we absolutely cannot damage front wing, or we bring an upgrade package, you know, very regular. I think the upgrade stuff is probably the same for a lot of teams. Mm. You bring an upgrade package and you'd say, we only have one on Friday. We absolutely cannot damage it. This is our test day. This is it. And then, but you, the other ones arrive on Friday night, we're going to be running Saturday. So teams sort of manage that resource within the risk that you say. And like you say, that in itself brings disadvantages because you've not pushed hard into turn one until run one qualifying or whatever that might be. But yeah, the teams are just operated in a slightly different way.
Your 7 years in Formula One, you will have seen a lot of changes, a lot of development, just the nature of the sport, but also, you know, digitization and technology has moved on incredibly fast in the last decade, in the last 7 years. How would you say, from when you perhaps started working in the strategic, looking at strategy and race strategy, how would you say that job has changed in the time you were doing it?
Yeah, so the strategy role, you know, fundamentally is the same since I started. So there's no difference in our output. There's no difference in what we do. I think the biggest differences have been the progression of information that we have. So, you know, when we started, there was probably quite limited information about others and ourselves, you know, what we're doing. But now that has grown and grown, and the data sources have grown and grown. So now you've got like GPS for every other car. You can track what they're doing. You can track when they're lifting. You can track what they're doing in practice or qualifying. You know, whether you think they've got their engine turned up or not. There's so much more information just available in that stream alone. A few years ago, there was a lot of discussion around the radio comms aspect of F1. So we went through a year where F1 limited the radio comms that we could say to the driver, such that there was less driver coaching. And then it got to a point where they just said, we're going to open up all of the radio comms. You can say whatever you want to the driver, but we are going to give it to all the other teams as well. So now everything that's said from the pit wall to the driver is available to us live in the race and post-race for analysis. And that has been massive because some teams have gone down the road of, okay, we're going to use code words and we're going to do X, Y, Z and we're going to try to really restrict it. And another team's just said, well, we're going to use the standard terminology that we've always sort of used, but we're going to be pretty open because that's just the easiest way to communicate with our driver. So that those two streams, I would say, are there's a lot more information on the go now than there used to ever be.
How much are you actually focusing on the opposition during race strategy? You know, is it easy to get bogged down with focusing on deciphering different code words and all the rest of it? Where do you sort of strike that balance between focusing on yourself and focusing on the opposition?
Yeah, so the focus is really interesting. We've got, and every team will have the same, teams will have a group of people back in the factory that are just listening to competitor audio and trying to strip out the important from the not important. And like I said before, sort of pass that up the field. So, you know, some things I don't care about, we can go through later, but some things are important right now. So if we think a team's considering boxing, and then again, what's relevant is how close that team is to us. I've seen in the past, you know, there are a few really good examples a few years ago, a bit like we talked about earlier, people are trying to, you know, I think it was AlphaTauri at one point, were really focused on beating us in the championship. We were next to them in the Constructors' Championship. So their whole race just seemed to be, didn't matter what points they scored as long as they beat us. And you get this really interesting dynamic where teams are just solely focused on another team and actually do really poor overall strategies, but have beaten, tried to beat the team they aim to do. So there is a really fine line by saying, okay, you know, we are next to X team in the championship. We want to cover those. So we're ahead. We're just going to cover every pit stop. That's going to be fine. But if you're just covering every pit stop to no point scoring position. So there's a really interesting, you need voices of reason on both sides. So we often have people that we talk about being like in a capacity seat who don't get pulled down into the nitty gritty of what's happening in that thing, but just sort of a bit more big picture and say, oh, well, yeah, you can copy them on their five-stop strategy, but that's totally not the right thing to do. You know, everyone else is on a one-stop, so it doesn't matter specifically in this instance about that team. So there's a few real intricacies there in terms of trying to get the best for you. You also need to be careful that, you know, teams can call things because they know, I know other teams are listening to us. So you need to take every radio call with a little pinch of salt because you don't quite know what's happening. You also know, you build up this understanding of a team's behaviour. So we know, for example, from previous races that some teams are very aggressive on the undercut, will go very, very early for an undercut race. We know people like Alonso do a lot of management initially and then will push at the end. So he always looks really slow when he initially comes out. There's a few things that you start to build, you know, and it leads on to sort of the topic of where we see strategy going, where we see development going, and that, you know, if you could 100% model all those behaviours, because it's just behaviours or trends, then can you start to forecast what you think others will do in certain situations?
Where do you see AI's involvement in race strategies moving forward? You touched on it a bit there, but let's go into that a little bit more detail. Sort of where do you see sort of technology playing its part in Formula One and other sports moving forward, other motorsports moving forward?
Yes. So like I think up until this stage, the technology, the development, the software, you know, the F1 teams are always working on the software, has been fundamentally to help ease the decision-making process. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of strategy is just based on lap times. But if you think of the qualifying situation where you're trying to improve a lap time, even just taking the two numbers away from each other to get a delta is a bit of brain power that I don't need to use. So we've just been building bits of software that, you know, feed that information in the clearest form possible, clearest display possible. And that's progressed quite a lot, I would say, over the time. Now we're moving to more advanced simulation, more advanced forecasting. You know, there's lots of aspects of that which are continually being worked on. You know, the driver simulator stuff, the forecast, you know, and the CFD of aerodynamics. Well, we think specifically on strategy, then we should be starting to model trend, people, teams, environments. So, you know, we know the Monaco example is a classic one. It's very difficult to overtake. What do teams tend to do? How many times this year have any of the teams, Haas, Williams, whoever, split their start tire? How many times have they started on the wrong start tire, you know, in a conventional race sense, you know, the hard or the, you know, whichever one? And you should be fit to, with, you know, the help of AI and training some models, to say, okay, these teams have tended to do this or react in a certain way to a safety car at this point, or do a strategy that we believe, given our numbers, is slower, or really simple things like always suffer higher degradation on X tire, so we'll avoid that at all costs. So there's lots of things that we build up perception on the pit wall currently that should be trended. And it would be a really interesting experiment because, I think, but I've now left the team after 7 years. So although the processes are still the same, the team is still the same, the tire model and would still be the same, a lot of things will remain as is. You know, could AI pick up a shift in how things are done and reactions to certain things? And it would be quite interesting to sort of see, you know, and often we talk about that even in the office. We'll say, oh, so-and-so's moved from this team to that team. So you maybe know a little bit about that person or know a little bit how they react, but you should be fit to model all that, trend all that. And what you should ultimately end up with is a AI model that's fighting you, that's reacting in a way that you would expect the other nine teams to react, and telling you exactly what it projects they, what it thinks they will do at each point. And therefore, you are just coming up with a strategy against that.
That's incredible. The idea that, and of course it's going to come along, but to start modeling behaviors and also propensity for mistakes, and you know, to factor that into, well, okay, if 8 out of 10 times, you know, the tire might be wrong at the start, then we can expect that we might make an advantage here. Or if Fernando is bringing his tires in very slowly, then actually if we pit a little bit later or a little bit earlier, then it gives us this kind of advantage. Just a comment, I think that's absolutely fascinating when you start blending in the human part of it with modeling it and making pictures then for your race. How far away do you think that is?
I would say, you know, without having been directly involved in it, for some of the top teams, that's not that far away. I think they're definitely progressing that. You end up with, you know, in all of our worlds, that sort of aspect of life isn't that far away.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's interesting in that that's maybe one of the things we talked about, changes in the sport maybe earlier, but that's one of the things I think has changed a little bit. When I joined McLaren, there was this massive development side because they had the money to throw at it, and they were developing, you know, different carbon fibers, different materials, different cooling systems, whatever it might be. And that has sort of shifted a little bit, that now in this aspect, potentially, F1 aren't the front runners anymore. You know, there's definitely more technology giants out there doing much more interesting AI things than we are. You know, like the Googles of this world that are looking at driverless cars and all this sort of thing. You sort of think that that's the sort of, we need to bring on more of that aspect, bring on more of those software guys and girls. So yeah, I think that's something that we're playing a little bit catch up on, because that technology totally exists. We just need to get it on board. And I think as teams do that, they will progress.
Effectively, is that taking away the person from the role, where you could put anyone to that role and they're fitting the algorithm for the team? Or is it where at the moment you're seeing that if someone goes and moves from a McLaren to an AlphaTauri, for example, you're seeing the same traits that they were portraying in the team before? Or do they very much go into the AlphaTauri way of working? You know, sort of, is that, yeah, something that's very obvious? Because obviously the demands are going to be very different from if someone's moved from a top team to a bottom team. And then how do you actually put that together to make the algorithm something that actually is valid for that team? And
I think it's a real hybrid. So, you know, like, nobody's standalone. So as a strategist, if I was to move to a different team, then that different team might produce a slightly different tire model. And fundamentally, so much of what I do is based on the tire model. So if you have a very different tire model, you end up with very different strategies, and it all mingles together, or different organizational structures of different sort of sign-off criteria, or a different decision-making process, or any of these sorts of things. So, you know, any of the teams, any of the decisions, any of the output is a hybrid of all of the characters involved and all of the aspects that come together. I sort of see, in the same way that you can't imagine us ever getting to the point where, you know, it's a driverless car, you know, if you think of the most most ridiculous solution, I don't think you're ever going to get away from having people on the pit wall. I don't think you're ever going to get away from that human interaction. And I'd hate to see that. I'd hate to see us get away from that. What I would like to, you know, what if I was continuing to do the job, having that insider knowledge of what you think the others can do was really useful. But you're obviously, I don't think we're ever going to replace the strategy department, if you want, with an AI. But I'd hate to see us move away from that, because you do need to work together. You know, one of the things that we've not really talked about so far is you know, a strategist working with an engineer or an engineer working with a driver, it becomes like this relationship where you need to understand what they're saying, they need to understand what you're saying, and the drivers really need to buy in at the beginning of the race. This is what we're going to try and do. This is what we're going to try and avoid. These are the situations that we might get stuck in. You know, a bit like we mentioned a little bit earlier, is a plan that says we want to go to lap 40, but you're going to be stuck in traffic for the first 20 laps. If you get frustrated, this isn't going to work. We need to manage that, push at the end. So you really need to have this level of communication. It's so important that they understand, especially with the limited comms in the car. They're massively overloaded in the car. So you need to get this like simplistic message through as well as you can.
Yeah.
And on that topic, I know one of the things that you're looking at moving forward is actually working on how Formula One is getting across to the fans and the explaining strategy better. Why don't you just talk a little bit into that in terms of what you're looking at and how actually Formula One, Sky are trying to build more in for the fan engagement?
Yeah, so I think the F1 is really at this, it's really started to propel itself forward in terms of its very increasing fan base. Like you mentioned, that a number of events that we've gone to recently, you can really see the numbers ramp up. You can really see the interest. I'm getting people asking me now more about F1 than I've ever had. Friends that, you know I work in F1, but have no interest in what I do, are now starting to sort of understand little bits or starting to pick up on little aspects of it. So that group's really growing. But then you've now got this hybrid audience of people who've watched F1 and loved F1 for a long time, and relatively new audience that we need to get on board with a number of aspects of F1. And that's just like explaining what we're trying to do, explaining the strategies, explaining the team aspects. So part of what I'm going to try to achieve is through a race weekend or through, you know, post-race, simplify the strategy story as much as possible. And there's a number of means of doing that. And there's a lot of media outlets, digital outlets, they're now trying to explain through the race what the strategies are, trying to visualize what the strategies are. It's very hard to tell, particularly the midfield story. The front three is maybe, you know, more televised and more easy to understand. But it is such a complex situation with very complex needs going on, differences going on. You know, the multiple stop races that we've now achieved this year are great for F1, but they're much more confusing to tell the story of. The one stop races are reasonably simple. So what I'd like to work on is the visualization of that, how we can best represent it. You know, is that with F1 through their app? Is that through different bits on Sky? Is it through, it's just visualizing the problem, just visualizing what's going on. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, hopefully good work going on in the background. I think there's a definite need for that to continue. There's a lot of people out there trying to fill that gap in very certain ways. So it's just to try and, yeah, hopefully we're going to try and bring a body of work together that will help engage the fans and the strategy aspect in particular, and help to say, this is what happened or why or the differences.
That's fantastic. So if I can put you on the spot maybe a little bit. So we will be releasing this just before the Belgian Grand Prix weekend at Spa. So let's all become armchair strategists. What are you looking out for at Spa? What are the key points there that maybe if you're just watching from your seat, you wouldn't necessarily be considering? So you might be thinking, well, maybe it's a one stop, maybe it's a two stop. Maybe it's hacking down with rain and not much is going on. So all I can think about is strategy. But what are you looking for?
Yeah, so I think that I have not given out a great deal of thought at this stage, but the interesting things for Spa, you know, it's a very long lap. This year, we've obviously got big changes to the cars aerodynamically. It's generally got a very long DRS zone. So there's a few big changes there that might potentially, it's going to be interesting to see how that affects the overtaking. So Spa's traditionally, you know, an okay circuit for overtaking. So has that come down even further than we'd expect? So that's one thing. The rain always features in Spa, or at least the weather conditions. So even if it's not rain, it's a big change in ambient or a big change in track temperature. Those things are definitely going to be influential. You've also got the very long straight for any of the porpoising effect that obviously we're trying to get away from. So I think there's going to be a few interesting interactions through that aspect. Yeah, from a strategy side, it's always one of these ones. It's the first one post-break. So it's getting everyone back into it. You know, there's a few interesting interactions there. It's the first one in the triple header. So across those three, there's quite a lot going on. Are people going to bring big upgrades post-shutdown? Because it's the first one of three. So if you're trying to get something in, you'll try and get it in for the three.
Just to follow on that point of perhaps your first race outside of that team environment for a while, did you ever feel sympathy for other teams when strategy perhaps went wrong? And do you think you'll have more empathy now when perhaps something goes wrong? Go, ah, yeah, I can see how they've made that mistake. And that's an easy one to make.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I would like to think that I had always pretty strong empathy for when people made strategy mistakes, generally because, you know, obviously we're all competitors, we're all trying to do our best, so nobody's making a mistake because they don't care. And generally you don't know what's going on in the background, so a bit like in everyday life when people make mistakes, you're not quite sure what's going on in the background. So, you know, you don't know if they were worried about tire life or whatever it was that made them stop on a certain lap. And that's sort of why I listened to the intercom, you know, the driver comes to try and find what is the picture there, because it is more difficult and there are pressures for whatever reason that mean you might take one decision over another that maybe to someone else's clear cut. For me personally, it's been the first time since 2013 that I've watched a race not involved with the race.
Mm.
That's going to be quite a big adjustment. I think the things I'm looking forward to are, you know, a better, you know, what we talked about, we're trying to improve the strategy visualization to others. You know, obviously I actually lack a lot of understanding of how people watch the race, how they understand, how it's presented to them, you know, what sort of information is correct or incorrect in my mind.
Mm.
So I'm looking forward to going through that process of understanding how it's presented and the potential downfalls in that. But what I'm worried about is not having all my data. So yeah. I've, you know, watched a race for the last, you know, if we round up slightly, close to 10 years, with all of the data, all of the lap times, all of the degradation curves, all of the pit losses, you know, with my nice race trace, which we use a lot to show where people have stopped, what people have done and what traffic they've had. So I'm a bit worried about that.
It's going to feel like, yeah, it's going to feel like two hours of feeling like you've lost your keys.
And, yeah, exactly.
Well, so, how do I... that's really interesting, but I hope you're able to enjoy it despite not having all the data. What's coming next for you then with the work you're doing with F1, and how can people get in touch with you also?
Yeah, so what come next, we're pretty open. I'm just sort of trying to explore the possibilities as they come along. I think as people we're very guilty of almost boxing ourselves into this little environment. So I can always think of myself as a strategist.
Mm.
But what's important to me now is to use the traits, the attributes, the experience I've gained, and, you know, apply that differently. So, you know, that might be the performing under pressure or communication skills on the pit wall or any of the sort of teamwork aspects. But there's a load of strengths there that, you know, as people we tend to ignore. And we tend to just think, oh, you know, I'm just an F1 strategist and let's just do that forever. But there are a load of really interesting things there that can be applied in lots of really different ways. So I think part of my goal now is to try and think of how that can be applied. I'm really interested in getting involved in, you know, some different industries. And like we sort of said earlier, I really enjoy learning. So just to see a little bit how that can be applied and what we can do forward. I think, like you mentioned, you know, working with F1, for an example, a vast majority of that initially at least is going to be focused heavily on F1 or motorsport, which is brilliant. And it would be really nice to see that from a slightly different angle, just to see a slightly different aspect of it. In terms of getting in touch with me, I've not got loads set up yet, but you know, you can get me on LinkedIn in particular. That's a pretty good way to get in touch with me. Or you know, on Instagram or Twitter. If you just quickly search, then it should be findable.
Perfect.
Yeah, and just to add to that also, Bernie is one of our motorsport speakers on the Ignition Human Performance website. So if people want Bernie to come and talk around strategy, decision making, all the stuff we've spoken about today, and much, much more, then yeah, the one way to get in contact is to head over to motorsportspeakers.com. And yeah, what a fantastic person to come and have speak to your business about all the different areas that we've discussed today. I mean, a real insight, and you know, thank you so much for your time, Bernie. Really appreciate it.
Not a problem.
It has been absolutely fantastic. In fact, I think we could have probably done 3 or 4 podcasts, because I wanted to ask so much more about tires, for example, and the new tires and regs and engines and everything coming in that's going to be impacting. But we perhaps will save that for another time. So just to echo Nick's words, thank you so much, Bernie, for taking the time with us today.
No problem. Thank you all, guys.
This is Tomorrow's Motorsport.